Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. I encourage you to check out our website, www.compassionatecooks.com, to join our fabulous Compassionate Cooks Club, to order our cookbooks, The Joy of Vegan Baking and The Vegan Table, to connect with other podcast listeners, and to just find a bunch of resources and information about living a compassionate life. I'd like to first start by thanking our supporters of the podcast. These are people who are now members. They used to be sponsors of the podcast, but now we've folded in the sponsorship program into the membership program. So these are still people who support Compassionate Cooks and who I'd like to honor on the podcast. The first person I would like to thank is Sarah Facey. Sarah wanted to dedicate her sponsorship to her friend Karen. I'm assuming it's pronounced Karen. It's spelled K-A-R-I-N, so I don't know if it's Corinne. But Sarah said that Karen, is a true friend to the animals. Sarah wrote the following. Karen has a house full of rescued birds and cats and a lovely dog called Annie. Just as an aside, she has a website of children's stories about the animals that have lived with her. You can find that at birdsshouldfly.co.uk. They're in the UK. So anyway, I wanted to dedicate my sponsorship to her because she reminded me of something I'd cared about when I was younger and had shut my ears to when I grew up, which is the way our society treats animals. Also, I wanted to dedicate my sponsorship to author Diane Sylvan, who has often blogged about veganism and helped change my mind on the subject. And thanks for all the great work you do as well, Colleen. I'd like to dedicate my sponsorship to you, too. So thank you, Sarah. Thank you for honoring all of those people. I know Diane Sylvan. I believe she's a listener of the podcast. And so it's really nice to give a shout out to her. Also, I would like to thank Peter Liu. Peter wrote a really lovely email that I will read. He wrote, "Dear Colleen, my partner Eric and I have had an idea of opening a vegan restaurant in New York City about a year ago. After a year of hard work, the cafe is going to open in the next couple of weeks." So Peter wrote this in about May of 2009. So if you hear this afterwards, definitely go check this out. It has been a tough journey because of our limited budget. Through the process, we were discouraged many times by landlords because of their perception that a vegan restaurant would not make any money. Then we almost abandoned the project when the economic downturn hit last November. But my partner reminded me again that opening this vegan restaurant has a much more profound meaning, that is to celebrate and promote this lifestyle. I guess this is our way of activism, and we have to forge ahead, overcoming our fear, and finish up with this meaningful project. After the new year, we found this lovely space in a nice residential neighborhood. We had to transform this existing dental office into a vegan kitchen and bakery. Our idea is to create a comfortable, homey place for all vegans and non-vegans to hang out and get good quality vegan food. We want to serve food with mindfulness, and hopefully it will become a transformational eating experience for others, like vegans or not. Now, the place is almost done, and we'll have to test out the kitchen and try out our menu. Eric is a compassionate and passionate cook, and he will be running the cafe. I'm still keeping my day job and probably will help out over the weekends. We're very excited that we'll be meeting a lot of new vegans and soon-to-be vegan friends, and we'll be spreading the news to those who are not familiar with this compassionate way of living. At last, we have to thank you for all the knowledge that you have given us and those who have an open heart to listen and reason. We had been vegetarian since 2001. Your truthful message has made us realize that being vegan is the only way to be. So on New Year's Day in 2007, after we almost overdosed on cheeses, we both turned vegan. I listened to your podcast over and over again, especially now that I have to increase my knowledge of veganism so I can take on a role of spreading the word in the cafe. We don't want to cause any suffering to ourselves, and we certainly don't want to cause suffering to the animals. That's why we named our place Peace Food Cafe. We believe peace begins on our plate. So this sponsorship is for our friends and companions, the animals. Thank you so much, Peter and Eric, and thank you, Sarah. If you would like to support the work of Compassionate Cooks and help this podcast keep going, I hope you'll consider becoming a member of our Compassionate Cooks Club. We created it as a way to include everyone into the Compassionate Cooks family. That's why we folded in the membership. And the sponsorship programs, it really makes sense to just have one place where everybody can come together, and we're really thrilled about the response so far. There are lots of perks and benefits and discounts depending on the level you choose. You can contribute as an annual member or a monthly member. So check out CompassionateCooks.com and click on the buttons that encourage you to join the club. After the success of the launch party for the vegan table, which we just had recently, I was thinking how fun it would be to have an annual party for Compassionate Cooks Club members. Won't that be cool? So anyway, thanks for your support, and I look forward to hearing from you. So on to the topic for the day. If you've ever stared at the nutrition facts label on the back of food products, wondering what to make of it, then this episode is for you. However, please know that as conscious as I am of my non-US listeners, this episode is pretty US-centric, as I'll be deconstructing the elements of the nutrition facts label, which is regulated by the US Department of Agriculture and the US Food and Drug Administration. I do think, though, that many of the things I'll be talking about will still be relevant to you no matter where you live or what your own nutrition labels say, and there are regulated nutrition labels in Canada, in Mexico, in the European Union. So I know that there are a lot of things that I'm going to talk about that are going to be universal, not only because there's similarities on those labels, but also because I'll be talking about nutrition recommendations and just some other interesting things that come up. So stay with me. I think this will appeal to everyone no matter where you live. I'd like to talk more about food regulation and the history and politics behind food regulation and food labels in another episode, the history of all of that in another episode, because we have enough to talk about just in relation to what the labels say. But I do want to point out, I think this is really interesting, and we'll come back to it, if you don't know this already, that in terms of food safety, one of the more significant events that took place in the last century, was the passage of the Meat Inspection Act in 1906, and it was a result of Upton Sinclair's expose of the meat industry in his novel, The Jungle. So if you haven't read it yet, I really encourage that you do. It detailed the horrendous sanitary and working conditions in the meatpacking industry. And it's an interesting story. Many laws followed after that in terms of food regulation. So I just wanted to point that out in terms of the whole arc of this story. But we'll come back to that and go into that in more detail in another episode. For our purposes here in this episode, we need to jump to 1994, when food labels became regulated. Isn't it kind of crazy that it took so long? 1994 was not that long ago. Before then, food companies could print their products' nutritional information basically anywhere they wanted to, and often in very small print, so they weren't held accountable at all. So the new regulations required both that the ingredients and the nutritional information be provided along with a food label of a standard size and a standard shape, and it's labeled nutrition facts. Now, you can find how to read a nutrition label all over the internet, but hopefully I can make this interesting for you and unique. So why don't I tell you how I read a label, and then I'll deconstruct the label itself. We'll do this together, but I'll tell you how I look at a nutrition label. I suppose the first thing that most people look at are the calories when they're looking at a label. And I suppose it depends on why you're looking at the label, but I don't look at the calories first. The first thing I look at is the ingredients list. I want to know exactly what's in this thing. And the list itself tells you a lot. Not only what's in it, of course, but it also gives you an idea of the quantity of each of the ingredients. Now, what I mean by that is that the first thing listed in the ingredients list is what there is most of in that product. It's listed in order of the quantity. So if sugar is first, then it has more sugar than anything else. If oil is listed first, then it has more oil than anything else. So that's the first thing to know. The ingredients go from highest quantity of something to the lowest. The ingredient that's listed last, as you would guess, shows up in the least amount in that product. Okay, so I think that's really helpful to know. So you can really get a sense of how much of each thing is in that product. The other thing I notice right away when I look at the ingredients list is how many ingredients there are. It's a rare day that you'll find me put something in my shopping cart that has an ingredients list of, more than six ingredients. Now, some things have more than six and they're still whole ingredients. It really depends. But once you have a ton of things listed on that list, you're often into the territory of chemicals and preservatives. So that's kind of the first thing I notice too when I just look down at the list, and if it's very large, I'm a little suspicious. So that's the third thing to look at, is what are those things made up of? What are these ingredients? If I'm looking at a chemistry textbook rather than reading what should just be a food label, then it goes back on the shelf. I pretty much want to be able to pronounce everything that's in my food. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some words that might be unfamiliar to you, but you get the idea. You want to be familiar with everything that's on that label. You don't want to just eat a bunch of preservatives. And that's what most of that stuff is. As you start to get into a list of, you know, preservatives and chemicals and unfamiliar sounding words, that's what most of it is. It's mostly preservatives, and it's meant to increase the shelf life of products. And just translate what that means to your body. Like, the crap that's in this product is meant to stop it from breaking down. Hello, I don't want to put things in my body that don't naturally break down. Like, my body's not a landfill. I just picture a landfill, like, of things just sitting there for thousands of years. I mean, I'm not going to live for thousands of years, but still, I just don't want things sitting in my body that don't break down. My body's not a landfill. So I don't want to put all these artificial preservatives in my body. I have to tell you this really funny story. I hear a lot of stories from people about how they go vegan, how they have this awakening, what that moment was for them. And I was really struck once in a cooking class when a woman told me a story. I can't remember if it was a friend of hers or a brother or a boyfriend or something, who worked in a funeral home. And so he did, you know, he prepared the bodies for viewing. And she became vegetarian because her friend told her that bodies these days are so well preserved because of all the crap that's in the body, from all the preservative that's in the meat and all the preservatives that's in all of the processed foods, that the bodies are coming to him so much more preserved than they ever had before. And she was really freaked out by that. And that's when she went vegetarian. That was really interesting, unique path to vegetarianism. But that's what I'm talking about here. That's just crap. Yes, I said crap. Now, manufacturers now have to include the quantity of trans fats in terms of grams of trans fats in a product. But I tend not to look at the quantity of trans fats because I can identify them really easily by just looking at the ingredients list. This is why I like the ingredients list so much, because you have such clues as hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated oils. So if they're showing up on the ingredients list, there are trans fats in that product. So we'll talk more about this when I get down to the fat part of the nutrition label. Okay. Now, the last thing I look at, of course, is what in this ingredient might not be vegan. And so I'm looking for animal products. Now, there's common ones to be aware of. We're familiar with a lot of them. If something says milk, if something says eggs, it's pretty obvious, but there are some others that you just might not be aware of, and I'll just go through these quickly. Now, I'm focusing on food labels here, not all the hidden ingredients and things like cosmetics and such. So I'm really just focusing on food. And once you know these things, it's just a matter of a quick glance at a food label. So besides eggs, albumin is actually egg white. So you'll see that on a label and you'll know right away that's from eggs. That's A-L-B-U-M-E-N. It's basically the egg white. Bonito is dried flakes from fish, and it's often in Japanese products. We talked about this, gosh, which episode was it? I can't remember which episode it was, but we talked about carmine or cochineal or carminic acid. And these are all the different names for ground up beetles. And they're red or purple. Anything that has like red, an artificial red color in it, like applesauce, if there's red applesauce or red fruit drinks or red lollipops, they are from the crushed up beetles. But I thought you might be interested in this. There's an update on the labeling of this. In January 2009, the FDA announced that all foods and cosmetics containing cochineal extract or carmine must contain a quote-unquote prominent and conspicuous declaration of these ingredients by name at least once on the item label. Previously, these colorings derived from the female beetles, they could just be declared on the label under a generic color added label or something similar. So they do have to declare very specifically that it's cochineal or carmine. Now, the ruling becomes compulsory in January 2011. Right now, it's just a matter of voluntary compliance. So they're still not writing beetles, you know, which I think would make people step back. They're not writing insects as the ingredient in that product, but at least they can't just say color added. They have to say where it's from. So casein, you know about casein. Casein is cow's milk protein. It's milk protein, basically. And you'll see it in non-dairy creamers. And you'll even see it in some soy cheese. It might be casein. It might be caseinate. It might be sodium caseinate. So you'll look for that. Gelatin, obviously, that's the boiled up remnants of a slaughterhouse. So it's skin and tendons and ligaments and bones. And it's mixed with water. And that becomes this gelatinous substance. And that's in, you know, fruit gelatins and jello and some puddings and marshmallows and some candies and cakes and that kind of thing. So gelatin, lactic acid. Now, lactic acid can be plant derived. And so the label will often say if it is vegan or plant derived, it will indicate that. So that's good. Lactose is obviously the milk sugar from the milk of animals. Lard is fat from pig stomachs. Lipids, lipids are just fats. They can also come from plants or animals. And again, when they're from plants, they'll say so. Natural sources can mean either animal or vegetable. It's kind of what I was just saying about color added. It can just be this vague generic term. So, yeah, you don't really know unless you're getting a product that you know is vegan or from a company that you know is vegan. Rennet is the enzyme from calves' stomachs. We talked about this in the All About Tofu episode. So rennet or renin, R-E-N-N-I-N or R-E-N-N-E-T. And urea or uric acid, that's excreted from urine or other bodily fluids. So when you see that, you know that's an animal product. And whey, there can be soybean whey, but if it just says whey, it's most likely animal-based. So those are the basic ones that you're going to see on the ingredients list that will tell you that animal products are in that product. Now, in 2004, there was the passage of the Food Allergy Labeling and Consumer Protection Act. This requires labeling of any food that contains one or more of peanuts, soybeans, cow's milk, eggs, fish, crustacean shellfish, tree nuts, and wheat. For liability purposes, though, I don't think it's required. Manufacturers will also disclose if a product may contain wheat ingredients because of the way or because of where it was manufactured. It might also say manufactured in a processing facility that also processes milk and soy ingredients. So it's really there for liability purposes. And people have asked me if I, from a vegan perspective, buy or eat products that may be processed using machinery that has also had non-vegan products processed on them. Like non-dairy chocolate chips that also uses the same machinery for chips that have cow's milk. My answer, in short, is yes, I do. That kind of low-level concern about purity is not why I'm vegan. And it doesn't make me less vegan if I eat chocolate chips that were processed on machinery that also processed non-vegan chips on them. So yes, I do. I eat them. And it's really there for liability purposes. It doesn't mean that they were processed in machinery that used cow's milk, and it certainly doesn't mean that there was cow's milk in the product. So that's that. From an allergy perspective, however, only you know how allergic you are to something to know if you'll be affected or harmed by even the smallest remnant of something like peanuts or soy or wheat, any of those top allergens. So that's a different story. From a purity vegan perspective, I'm not concerned about it. From an allergen perspective, that's a decision you're going to have to make yourself. So that's the ingredients list. That's the first place I start. Moving on to other components of that nutrition facts label. According to the Nutrition Label Act, serving size has to be the first thing listed. And this is definitely important when you're looking at a label because you really need to understand how to calculate the total calories you're eating based on serving size. And this is especially true if you're watching your calories either to lose weight or to gain weight. So for instance, if you have a box of cookies and under calories it says 200, well, you need to look at what serving size that 200 calories is. If the serving size is 10 cookies, it might say 10 cookies, it might say 10 pieces. That means if you eat 10 cookies, you're eating 200 calories. So the serving size is 10, the calorie is 200. If you eat 20 cookies, then you're eating 400 calories because you have to multiply that. Right, so more than that, you need to also know how many servings per container there are. And that's right there in that same section. That way, if you eat the whole thing, which I know some of us do, don't even ask me. I can't even have a bag of veggie booty in the house because I will eat that whole bag and I don't even want to look at how many calories are in the veggie booty bag. But so that way, if you eat the whole thing, and I know there are other people out there who eat the whole thing, in a sitting. Mm-hmm, very dangerous to do. That way you know how many calories you're eating if you eat the whole bag. It's so embarrassing to admit, but I have to admit it. So if we continue with our example, if it says servings per container 5, it means you're eating 1,000 calories if you eat the whole box of cookies, right? So that was 200 calories per serving. Right? That was for 10 cookies. And if I'm eating, and if there's 5 servings per container, I have to multiply 200 calories by 5 servings. And since the servings is 10 cookies, it also means that you'd be eating 50 cookies in that sitting, which I don't advise you to do. I also don't advise you to eat an entire bag of veggie booty. That's just my personal opinion. So serving size and the servings per container, I think, are really important components of the label when you're trying to figure out calories, especially if you're trying to lose weight. So just underneath or next to calories is calories from fat. And this is also helpful to know. If under calories, it says 160, and under calories from fat, it says 130, that means a huge amount of the calories are coming from fat, right? That's about 80% of calories from fat. Now, that's not always necessarily a bad thing. In fact, the example I just used is from a container of roasted peanuts that I had in the house. So the serving size is 1 ounce, which is conveniently converted to a metric system for those outside of the United States. So it would be 28 grams. And also it's converted to volume, so a quarter of a cup. So you've got 1 ounce or a quarter of a cup. And the total calories is 160, and the calories from fat is 130. But we're talking about nuts, so that's why the fat is so high. It's also why the calories are high, because there are 9 calories in 1 gram of fat versus 4 calories in 1 gram of carbohydrates and 4 calories in 1 gram of protein. So that's why when you eat fewer fatty foods, you lose weight, because you're naturally taking in fewer calories. That's why people who switch from a high-fat animal-based diet to a low-fat plant-based diet tend to lose weight. So just remember what we talked about in the Healthful Eating in a Recession episode. When the fat calories are higher, in the case of healthful plant foods like peanut butter or avocado or almond butter, they're healthful calories. So even though they might be high in calories, they're healthful calories. In other words, you're getting a lot of bang for your buck. You're also getting, you know, you're getting protein, you're getting fiber, you're getting carbohydrates, you're getting potassium. So what we don't want is empty calories. That's when you get a lot of calorie load with no nutrition load. Like when you eat potato chips, you got a lot of calories and no nutrients. That's what it means to take in empty calories, okay? And that's not what we want. Now, continuing on down the label and staying with our conversation about fats, what you see next will be the quantity of total fat, saturated fat, trans fats, polyunsaturated fat, and monounsaturated fat. There was a time when the amount of trans fat in a product did not have to be listed. So people did not know how many grams of trans fats they were consuming. Only if you knew what to look for in the ingredients list did you know if trans fats were present, though you didn't know the quantity in terms of grams. So if partially hydrogenated fat or partially hydrogenated oils are listed in the ingredients list, then you knew you were eating trans fats. So a battle waged for years and years and years until finally, the FDA made it a requirement for manufacturers to include the amount of trans fats in a product. It's been on labels now since 2006. The FDA had required saturated fat and dietary cholesterol to be listed on the food label since 1993. So you can see the disparity there. Now, I just want to say a brief word about trans fats. Trans fats are essentially artificially created by adding a hydrogen to a liquid vegetable oil, thus turning it into a solid fat. It's a process called hydrogenation. Hydrogenation basically increases the shelf life and flavor stability of foods containing these fats. That's all they're there for. Now, trans fats also occur in meat. They're also in meat. So that's what trans fats are. Now, even though it was a big deal to include the amount of trans fats on nutrition labels, and I support that because I think people should know what they're consuming and if information is being withheld from them, I think it's just really unethical. I also think the whole trans fat craze is a bit of a red herring in the sense that now people feel better eating crackers and cookies and snack foods and donuts and other crap made without partially hydrogenated oils. In other words, eating a trans fat free donut is still a donut. It's not health food. And I think the trans fat free craze sugarcoats, for lack of a better phrase, the processed junk food that people are putting in their mouths. It's true that trans fats, like saturated fat and dietary cholesterol, cholesterol raises the LDL, or the bad, quote unquote, bad cholesterol that increases your risk for coronary heart disease. But on average, Americans consume 4 to 5 times as much saturated fat as trans fat in their diet. So all I'm saying is that I don't think we're having a huge impact on our health when we switch from trans fat donuts to trans fat free donuts. And I think it gives people a false sense of security and a false sense of healthful eating. I will, however, recommend some really awesome trans fat free foods. They're called vegetables and fruits and nuts and seeds and whole foods. Okay, so those are great trans fat free foods. But the thing that drives me crazy is that even though we have no nutritional need for trans fats or saturated fats for that matter, people are told by the USDA, who sets the nutrition guidelines, to eat as few trans fats as possible. We don't need any trans fats. We need zero, zilch, zip, right? That should be the number that we shoot for, not as few as possible. I'm so tired of people not being given the information and not being given any credit. Like, you know, we can tell people that they don't have to eat trans fats at all, that pretty much it should be zero. Now, remember this too. This is very interesting when you're reading labels. Unless there is at least 0.5 grams or more of trans fat in a food, the label can claim 0 grams. So if it says trans fats, 0 grams, that doesn't really mean there are no trans fats in the product. So a savvy consumer knows that even if it says zero under the amount of trans fats, it doesn't mean zero, right? So amounts less than 0.5 grams are rounded down to 0 grams. So if a product contains 0.45 grams, okay, just under that 0.5, if it contains 0.45 grams of trans fat per serving, and the package contains 18 servings, the label will still show 0 grams of trans fat, even though the product actually contains a total of 8.1 grams if you multiply those two of trans fats. Just something to think about. So if you want to avoid trans fats completely, that's when you have to look at the ingredients list. That's why I love the ingredients list so much. So if you see hydrogenated oil, partially hydrogenated oil, you know that there are trans fats in that product, and that a zero really doesn't mean zero. Okay? Does that make sense? Now, saturated fat is the next fat listed. And we also have no nutritional requirement for saturated fat, as I said. It raises our LDL cholesterol, contributes to heart disease. However, not all saturated fats are created equal. And this is important for me to say because people know that saturated fat, I think they know, is primarily in animal flesh and secretions in their eggs and their milk. And that you greatly reduce your saturated fat intake when you switch to a plant-based, a vegan diet. But then they get confused because of plant foods like coconut butter or coconut oil that contains saturated fat. So here's the dealio. Though tropical oils like coconut palm oil and coconut oil do contain saturated fat, it's different on a molecular level. It's different than animal-based saturated fat, and it does not appear to have the same detrimental effect on our bodies as does animal fat. Now, that isn't licensed to drink vats of coconut oil, but what it does mean is that coconut fat can be a healthful part of a whole foods plant-based diet, okay? Now, having said all that, the USDA recommends that the total fat intake should be between 20 and 35% of total calories. I think that's very high. The USDA also recommends that no more than 10% of calories should come from saturated fats. The American Heart Association recommends that we consume less than 7% of calories from saturated fat. Honestly, though, I think there will come a time when we will also separate out plant-based saturated fat from animal-based saturated fat because they really aren't the same. But for now, those are the recommendations. If you're seeing a recommendation for a limited number of saturated fats, that's going to include plant and animal but they're really mostly thinking about animal fats when they give those recommendations. And since it's not required by the FDA, polyunsaturated and monounsaturated fats, they're not listed on the label, but sometimes you'll see them if the manufacturer wants to play them up for their healthful aspects. Now, I want to be clear. I said that I think 35% of fat of total calories is high, and I do think it is high. I tend to prefer the range of 10 to 15%, 20% at the very highest, and Again, that's fat from whole sources, whole fats, not from oil and not from processed fats. Okay, that is just my opinion. Cholesterol. After fats, you'll see the amount of cholesterol in a product. Now, the USDA recommends no more than 300 milligrams a day, which I also think is silly because we don't need to consume dietary cholesterol. Our body makes all the cholesterol we need. So if you're eating a plant-based diet, since there's no cholesterol outside of animal products, cholesterol exists only in animal products, then you're consuming zero dietary cholesterol, and that's a good thing. But that's what you'll also see on the product. On the label. Next, you have sodium. And the recommended daily limit for an average adult for sodium intake is 2,300 milligrams. The average American consumes about 3,500 milligrams a day. By the USDA's reckoning, a food is low in sodium if it contains no more than 140 milligrams. Now, a single serving of soup or frozen dinner may contain 1,000 milligrams or more of sodium, and these are small servings, which is a lot. So you really want to take a look at the sodium when you're looking at the soups and the processed things. Again, it comes down to processed foods because sodium is also a preservative. I mean, that's basically what it's doing. It's also increasing the shelf life of a food. So that's why you'll often find a lot of sodium in these products. However, I kind of think people don't understand sodium, or it can be another one of those red herrings where people who have high blood pressure and are told by their doctors to cut their sodium content. So what happens is they don't change anything else in their diet. So they're still eating meat and dairy and eggs and all of this stuff, but they stop putting table salt on their food, which I think is just silly. It doesn't do anything. I often, in my cooking classes, people will often say like, oh, I see you're using tamari or soy sauce. Do you have a low sodium one? Can you not use salt? Can I leave the salt out? Look, if you cut out the main sources of sodium in the American diet, and in the Western diet, really, which are animal products, meat and dairy, if you cut out these main sources of sodium, we can afford to have some table salt or some tamari, okay? So consider also that when you're putting a couple tablespoons of tamari into a whole dish, a stir fry or something, the idea is that you're splitting up that meal, I hope. I don't think you're eating the entire thing yourself. So even though it may seem like, oh gosh, a whole tablespoon of tamari is a lot, well, you're splitting it up and you're sharing it with other people. So you're not eating that whole tablespoon of tamari. But as I said, if you're cutting out the main sources of sodium in your diet, you can afford to have some tamari and some table salt. And I think I talked about this in another episode in terms of salting your food. When you're cooking and you're eating that food, you don't really taste the salt when you're cooking. So that's, I don't encourage you to keep salting while you're cooking. Just don't put the salt in while you're cooking. At the very end, taste it for salt. If you want to add some salt, go for it. Or you can just salt your food at the very end when you plate it. But now, I'm not giving medical advice here. If you are concerned about your blood pressure, then please keep an eye on excess sodium in your diet and, you know, go according to your doctor's recommendations. But remember, eating a whole foods plant-based diet will ensure a lower sodium intake than a processed diet full of canned soups, packaged foods, meat, and dairy. Okay? The next thing on the label are carbohydrates. Now, the total you'll see listed could be coming from refined sugar and refined grains or from healthful whole fiber-filled grains, okay? And the latter, obviously, are the better sources. This is why when you look at the label, you'll see sugars and dietary fiber grouped under carbohydrates. They're all under carbohydrates. And how will you know the sources of the carbohydrates in the food you're holding? By looking at the ingredients list. That's why I like the ingredients list so much. As a general guide, to make sure that you're consuming complex carbohydrates, besides making it a rule to just make the foundation of your diet whole foods, look for fiber on the label. If there are amounts for carbs and sugars, but no amounts for fiber, you're most likely eating refined carbs. Okay, so that's a good guide for you. And speaking of fiber, the next thing you'll see on that list under carbohydrates is dietary fiber. Now, fiber is found in complex carbohydrates, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, beans, and I have lots of information on fiber in various episodes. And you should know by now that fiber exists only in plant foods. Remember, we said cholesterol exists only in animal foods and saturated fat is primarily in animal foods. Fiber exists only in plant foods. There is no fiber in animal products, period. No fiber in meat, no fiber in cow's milk, no fiber in goat's milk, no fiber in llama's milk, no fiber in cheese, no fiber in eggs, nothing. Fiber is in plants. And people are definitely not reaching their fiber recommendation intake. So once you switch to a plant-based diet, easy peasy to get your fiber because it's in all the plant foods. The USDA recommends 25 grams of fiber a day for women, 38 grams a day for men. However, according to recent USDA surveys, the average intake of dietary fiber by women 19 to 50 years of age is 12 grams, and intake by men of the same age, 19 to 50, is about 17 grams. So, do you think it has anything to do with the fact that meat, dairy, and eggs are being consumed in huge quantities and plant foods are being consumed in very small quantities? The animal products totally displace the healthful, fiber-rich foods that are plants. It's not that complicated. This is so easy. It's so easy. And once people really have this basic information, I think they're really empowered to make their own changes. So there you go. Dietary fiber. Next on the nutrition facts label are sugars. And again, these are listed under carbohydrates. So when it lists the amounts of sugars, it's listing the number of grams of carbohydrates per serving specifically made up of sugar. And when you're looking at total carbohydrates, the closer the sugar gram value is to the total carbohydrate gram value, the less fiber you have in the food, the less satiated you'll feel, the more sugar you're consuming. So you want that sugar number to be low, okay? Now, protein is listed next. And as you know, in the average American diet, protein is derived primarily from meat and fish and eggs and cow's milk-based products. And the way you know where that protein is derived from when you're looking at a label is to look at the ingredients list. Protein is abundant in plant foods, obviously. And so protein needs vary depending on your weight and activity level. Check out other podcast episodes, including the first episode we ever did, which is called The Protein Myth, for more information about that. So protein is listed next. It's pretty straightforward. There's the grams of protein in that product. Now, in addition to listing these things by grams, you can also calculate what you're consuming if you go to the percent daily values. Now, this column displays, now, so right next to the grams, you'll have this column. It's the percent daily values. You might just see it D/V. This column displays the percentage of each thing listed based on a 2,000 calorie a day diet. So for example, a food that has 13 grams of fat per serving would state 20% in the daily value column. I don't agree with that. I think that's high. But the food label assumes that the typical adult needs 2,000 calories a day to maintain his or her weight. Now, most people fall somewhere in the middle. Men obviously require more calories than women to maintain their weight. So if you consume other than 2,000 calories a day to maintain your body weight, then these percentages will obviously be different. But the goal is, their intention was to create a way for people to determine if they're eating 100% of each of these nutrients every day, right? So if a serving of food is listed as 25% of the daily value of protein, then that food provides 25% of your daily protein needs based on a daily intake of 2,000 calories. The percent daily value can be a useful measure of whether a food is high or low in specific nutrients. A food is considered a good source of a nutrient if the percentage is between 10 and 19%. If a food has 5% or less, it's considered to be low. Okay. So that's just a general guide for the daily value, the percentage daily value. Now, related to this, you'll notice a chart that recommends that daily amount for each nutrient for both a 2,000 calorie diet and a 2,500 calorie diet. If you need to consume more or less calories than 2,000 or 2,500 a day, then this is not going to be useful for you at all. And I don't really find that chart very useful, to be honest with you. I'm just telling you what's on that label. Now, vitamins and minerals are also kind of the last thing you see at the very bottom of the nutrient facts label. The nutrition facts label. The only two vitamins required on the food label are vitamins A and C because of their historical importance to health. Both are measured in percentages, since the idea is to take in 100% of these nutrients daily in order to prevent deficiency diseases, which we don't have here. But so those are the only two vitamins required to list percentages on the label. Calcium and iron are the only minerals required on those labels, and they're also measured in percent daily values. So you'll see calcium, iron, A, and C required to be on the label. But sometimes you'll also see other vitamins and other minerals. And again, that's just because the manufacturer chose to put them there to really upsell those nutrients in that product. Now, besides understanding the food label, I mean, so that's all, that's it. I mean, that's the nutrition facts label. But we are bombarded with all this other marketing information on that product, obviously. And so consumers need to understand that many food manufacturers make health claims about their product. Studies show that consumers are really confused, really misunderstand the terms used. And many manufacturers use this confusion to their advantage when marketing their products. It's just kind of a fact. In 2003, the FDA changed the requirements for manufacturers making health claims on food labels. So originally, manufacturers had to demonstrate, quote unquote, significant scientific consensus before a claim could be made. Industry can now rely on, quote unquote, some scientific evidence or, quote unquote, very limited or preliminary scientific research to make health claims. So keep that in mind when looking at health claims on a food product label. It's really just another marketing ploy. I thought it would be helpful also to go over some of the other things we see on labels that also may confuse us. And I'm just going to go over a few of these and then we're going to wrap up. So you often see things like fortified or enriched. And they sound like positive things, but it actually means that the nutrients, such as minerals and fiber, have been removed and then vitamins have been added back in during processing. So even though enriched sounds good, it actually means something has been lost and taken away and then replaced. So what you want to look for is 100% whole wheat bread or 100% fiber. That means it's the whole thing to begin with and nothing has been stripped from it. Like, you know, if you have white rice and it's enriched white rice, it just means that all the fiber and everything's been taken off the white rice. And then some vitamins have been added back on because there are no nutrients now left on that food, if you can call it food. So you'll see things like sugar-free. Now remember our trans fat discussion about that 0.5 grams per serving? Remember what I said about that because that's going to be really helpful in understanding what I mean when I talk about the same thing in terms of fat or sugar. It's the same thing. So if something is called sugar-free, it means that it has less than 0.5 grams per serving. It doesn't mean it doesn't have any sugar. Isn't that bizarre? Isn't that just kooky? I just think that's so kooky. So you just can't believe it if something says sugar-free. It's really not sugar-free. Reduced sugar indicates that the product has at least 25% less sugar per serving than, I guess, the original product. No sugar added. This means that the products have had no sugar added during processing or packing, but they do not include products that already contain natural sugar, such as dried fruits and that kind of thing. So no sugar added just means that no sugar has been added during processing. It doesn't mean that they're sugar-free. Calorie-free means the product is fewer than 5 calories per serving. So calorie-free, not really. I mean, there's always going to be calories. That's stupid. Low calorie is an item that contains 40 calories or less per serving. Fat-free, back to our discussion again regarding the trans fats and the sugar-free. Fat-free means it's less than 0.5 grams of fat per serving. Not really fat-free. Saturated fat-free, same thing. Tells you that the product contains less than 0.5 grams per serving and the level of trans fatty acids is no more than 1% of the total fat. Got that? Let's see. Low fat is 3 grams or less of fat per serving. Reduced or less fat. This can be used on the label if there's at least 25% or less per serving than the original reference food. Are you confused yet? Mm-hmm. Reduced or less saturated fat, same kind of thing. If there's at least 25% less per serving than the original food. Light, L-I-G-H-T, and probably also light, L-I-T-E, means that the product has 50% less fat than the same original product. And it could also mean, it can also be used to mean 1/3 fewer calories or 50% less sodium. That's what light would mean. Cholesterol-free is any product that contains less than 2 milligrams of cholesterol or less than 2 milligrams of saturated fat. not cholesterol-free, really. When is it cholesterol-free? When it's plant-based. Good, good, great, good, good to know. Sodium-free. Sodium-free is less than 5 milligrams per serving. Low sodium is, so it's not sodium-free. Low sodium means the product is 140 milligrams or less per serving. Very low sodium means an item has 35 milligrams or less per serving. And reduced or less sodium requires that the product be at least 25% less per serving. I don't know if you got all that, but I think it's just really interesting to know just how what you're looking at isn't necessarily what the truth really is. Now, having said all that, having clarified all that about labels, I want to leave you with a final thought, and that is this. Most of the healthful foods you eat are those that don't have a label at all. Those are whole foods. Now, you know by now that I don't advocate perfection. I definitely buy things with labels. I buy canned beans and I'll buy canned soups and I'll buy, obviously, you know, condiments and that kind of thing. And even frozen fruit. Frozen fruit is required to have nutrition facts labels on them. I buy store-bought tortillas. I mean, so I'm not advocating perfection here. I definitely buy things with labels, but if we make the foundation of our diet good, clean, whole foods, then we really find that it's from unpackaged foods and we really limit the amount of processed packaged foods. And this is not only good for our health, it's also good for cost, it's also good for economic reasons, and it's also really good for environmental reasons because we don't have all this crazy packaging that is just wasteful and goes into a landfill somewhere. So when we're buying the packaged stuff, just try and choose those with the fewest ingredients, with ingredients whose names we can recognize. So I hope this provided some helpful information for you to reflect your values of compassion and simplicity and kindness and healthful eating in your everyday choices for the animals, both human and non-human. This is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.